Hi, welcome to Innovating Leadership, Co-Creating Our Future. I'm your host, Maureen Metcalf. I'm the founder and CEO of the Innovative Leadership Institute. We help elevate the quality of leadership across the world and work with those leaders to co-create a thriving future. Our work includes assisting leaders in identifying the disruptive trends that are impacting them and developing strategies to transform themselves and their organizations to thrive now and in the future. I'm a regular contributor to Forbes and the lead author on an award-winning book series focusing on innovating how you lead and transforming your organization. I'm also a fellow with the International Leadership Association. Today, I am delighted that we're going to talk about democracy and referendum with Matt Vortrup. Matt is a professor of political science at Coventry University. He is described by the Financial Times as a world authority on referendums. He's published more than a dozen books on democracy and presented on the BBC program, How to Kill a Democracy. So Matt, welcome. What do you want to tell our listeners about your background before we jump in?
Well, you pretty much oversold me there. I mean, I'm obviously pale into insignificance at your achievements. But yes, I am a political scientist. I was a lawyer in a previous incarnation. And it seems these days that law and politics sort of tend to go together, especially in your country. But that's another story. My interest is how to make societies better, really. And I think that goes through democracy and giving people responsibilities so they can take responsibility for their own actions so they can become responsible.
Well, and your work is so foundational right now to what's happening in the world. What drew you to this area?
Well, I think most of these sort of things happened by accident. In the 1990s, here showing my age when I was a student, I wanted to write about elections. And my supervisor in Oxford said, well, a lot of people have written about that. You should write about referendums and populism. That's a nice little area. It's not going to be that timely, but it's a good thing to write a PhD thesis about, which I then started to do. And then, of course, then the rest is history. So I started out of in a sort of academic way with an absolute pure academic interest. And then I realized this is quite a scary thing with referendums. They're referendums, it's a bit sort of like a Sergio Leone movie. They're the good, they're the bad ones, and they're the ugly ones. And recently in democracies, we've had more ugliness than we've had goodness.
So for our listeners who are less oriented in the political space, what is the study of referendums? Can you fill in a little bit more background?
Yes, the study of referendums is, in America, for example, you have ballot propositions. So at the same time as you have presidential elections or congressional elections, you vote on a number of issues. So when you vote on an issue, that is a referendum. So they voted in California a few days ago on whether Uber drivers should be given a salary or whether they're self-employed. Now that's an issue where the people themselves decide an issue. And I try to understand why certain states allow the people to have that direct say. And then, or why certain countries allow them to have that direct say. And then also, when do they vote for a thing like that? When do they vote against it? And what are the policy implications of having a system where the people, or a majority thereof, decide directly on issues rather than transferring their decisions to elected representatives? And, you know, that has kept me rather busy in the past few decades.
And so you advise political campaigns as well?
And governments. So I am in the fortunate position that this travels rather well in the times when you are allowed to travel. So last year I was in Papua New Guinea, which is an island state above Australia. And I was fortunate enough to be able to go there and suggest how they could have a fair vote. I've also been involved in votes all over the place, but including in America.
So our audience is international. So we'll be having a conversation with people from around the world. And depending on the topic, it is more American or less American. So what is your perspective on the state of democracy right now? You're writing about this during COVID, right?
Yes, you've got to have, I think Shakespeare wrote King Lear when he was sheltering from the plague. I'm not quite at that level, even if Coventry University, where I work, is very close to Stratford-upon-Avon, where Shakespeare was. But my lockdown project, my quarantine project, is called Death by a Thousand Cuts. And it is a book about the death of democracy, but it's a subtle, not happening too fast, sort of the bleeding away ever so slowly, so imperceptibly of democracy. So I'm trying to write about the, I suppose it's throughout history, really, because there's always been a particular way in which democracies have died. It's very rare that we have democracies that are overthrown by a military coup. Most democracies are overthrown gradually. Somebody gets elected, claims to speak on behalf of the people, and then gradually assumes more powers, will typically appoint judges, will claim to be more democratic than the other ones, but then with control over the state, will monopolize power, and then suddenly, presto, you are in a situation where democracy is no longer. If you go back to the Romans, Caesar Augustus actually gave citizens to all the people in peninsula of Italy. He said that they could even vote, and then they would send the votes to Rome, where he would be counting the votes, and therefore, not surprisingly, would win. And we see that same pattern there, interestingly, in the Roman case and in many other cases. Many dictators, many despots or demagogues have started by saying that democracy is stolen. Franco, the later became dictator in Spain, started his political career by saying that the 1936 election in Spain was, quote unquote, stolen. And then for that reason, obviously, things have to happen. And I'm not mentioning any particular people who might have followed the same strategy, but I think we have to be concerned when we see these tendencies. I'm not in this world to have a particular point of view. I am in the world to describe things. I'm a political scientist, but one of the things that I'm dealing with is democracies or the demise of democracies. And what I'm merely pointing out is that history may not repeat itself, but there's certain patterns that are eerily reminiscent of what things we've seen in the past. And I think people ought to know that so that they can make up their own minds as to whether they want history to repeat itself.
And so we're at the International Leadership Association conference. Do you have a particular message in the leadership space? Because we are recording this in the midst of the US presidential election while we're still waiting for a final decision on who our president will be. And so it's an interesting time to be having a conversation and to be remotely attending the ILA conference.
Yes, and I think one of the things that is interesting about dictatorship or demagogues or call it what you may, is that there are certain personality traits of those sorts of leaders. In a good leadership system, you have people who listen to experts. I think Machiavelli, the great Italian Renaissance writer, wrote in The Prince that the greatness of a leader is measured by the quality of his advisors. It wasn't gender neutral language in 1490 or when he wrote. but we can then, her greatness of her leaders is the quality of her advisors, if you like. But the and he also has a whole chapter called Warning Against Sycophants. So, you know, people who just say the right things. And the danger of having people who are of a more sort of despotic persuasion is that to their followers, they gain legitimacy by saying, well, I have God-given powers. I am the chosen one. I am all of these things. And therefore, I don't need to listen to people. I don't need to be humble because I know what is right. And I think that is the danger from a leadership perspective is that if you then have that view, that you have a monopoly on power, that you know all the right things, whether it's on tropical hurricanes hitting your country or whether it's on COVID or whatever it is, then you close yourself off to the possibility that you could be wrong. And therefore societies tend to be worse if you have these authoritarian personalities, whether in dictatorships or in democracies. So from a leadership perspective, you need to have leaders who are aware that they may not be the brightest candles on the cake, but who are able to delegate powers out to other people. And then they would have an idea, a philosophical vision of where you want to go. Now, I know we don't want to just talk about the American examples because we are an international organization, but most people tend to know the American examples. And if you take somebody like Ronald Reagan, who was a president, Republican president, time when I was growing up, that Ronald Reagan was much ridiculed for getting briefed on the golf course, and he would get little video, VHR tape, it wasn't, with 10-minute briefings, and people say, well, that's about his extension span. And actually, what was interesting about Ronald Reagan was that Ronald Reagan had exceptionally good people to advise him, and then he would get the sort of three bullet points from that, because Ronald Reagan had a vision for where America was going to be, but he was willing to and humble enough to delegate powers out. Ronald Reagan was probably not the most intelligent president you've ever had, but he was aware of his lack of intellectual prowess, and therefore he was able to delegate out. Another American president, Lyndon B. Johnson, was the same. He said, well, I'm a big guy from Texas, and I need these people to advise me, but I have a vision for what America can be. And the same, I think, is true if you look at great business leaders, if you look at great sports coaches. Those are people who have the greatness, they have the self-confidence to listen to people, to be able to take advice for those people who may have the right ideas. And we have a whole universe of ideas, and nobody can know everything perfectly well. So I think from a leadership perspective, the reason why I'm interested in dictatorship is not, I'm interested in its own right, I suppose, but the main sort of instrumental reason why I write about it is because these kind of systems where you have one individual who calls all the shots tend to be suboptimal, to use an economist's term, because they assume that you have all the knowledge, and you never have all the knowledge. You always need other people. So great leaders are the leaders who are humble, who are willing to listen, who are willing to delegate, and who have the ability to choose advisors who will support them and also speak truth to power.
You know, as you're saying that, I'm looking at our leadership competencies, and I have not done any work in the political realm. My COVID project is writing a textbook for healthcare leaders. So slightly different arena, but we both chose to write books during lockdown.
I know very little about the world of medicine and healthcare, but I think if you're a great surgeon, you would be happy to accept the advice of other people. So I think it's regardless of whether you're in healthcare or in oil or whatever you're in, you need to be open to the possibility that you might be wrong.
Mm-hmm. So in fact, I'm looking at our list of competencies. The first is professionally humble. I know where I am not the smartest person in the room or in the industry or in the field. And these things are moving so quickly that good leaders must be willing to seek input from others. And also, and this is what really, as I'm listening to you from the political arena, being clear on my principles, the principles of the party and the principles I hold, and living true to those principles, which connects then to the inspiring and vision. This is the vision we have. Then another is innately collaborative. So I have to seek input from others to ensure that the best outcome happens. Because again, Ronald Reagan didn't have all the answers, and we certainly don't now in our more globally interconnected and complicated world.
I couldn't agree more. But I think one of the problems that we then have is that we would then have to ask ourselves, why is it that people that feel this urge to go for leaders who have that sort of personality? And I think that's really the sort of the next big issue, because people often like to have not to do too much, really. I think the alternative to the sort of delegating all power to somebody that is seen to have supernatural powers is very dangerous, because then you lose your influence. And I think what we should do really is to find ways in which we can be more inclusive rather than exclusive. And people should also, I mean, this is not really a leadership point, it's more back to the democracy point. People need to become, you know, responsible for their own lives and responsible decisions.
I think that's the headline to me, is as busy as we all are living our lives and taking care of families and doing our work and staying healthy, that being a good political citizen, just an engaged citizen, is foundational to a healthy democracy.
And one of the things we, for example, at the International Leadership Association's conference, one of the participants is from Mexico City, Greta Reals, who has been instrumental in setting up this participatory budgeting, where ordinary people can decide on certain parts of the social security budget in Mexico City. It's not as if these people have massive resources. It's not as if any of them are economists, but they know that it's their lives. And therefore, people in Mexico City are willing to spend time and actually are given the opportunity to become responsible. And when they're given this opportunity to become responsible, they are no longer irresponsible, but they become responsible, literally, citizens. The same system has been pioneered in Brazil, also with great effect, where people feel that they're now part of life. They become much less skeptical. They become much more trustful because they cannot distrust themselves. And being part of the process has then had tremendously good effects at the local level. Now, of course, there might be other sort of at the macro level problems in both Brazil and in Mexico, but at the local level, and if all politics is, mm-hmm. is local, that is an empowering situation that I think we need to find all those examples of where people can become empowered through certain institutional structures.
So we started with your book and the chipping away at democracy. Do you have any thoughts on what helps us put those chips back? I don't know what the right terminology is, but if we're slowly losing that foundation, is it in service of something better, or are we losing something that's really good and we don't even notice it?
I think there's always a danger that you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You say, I don't like this, and then you're walking away from me. Right? Most people in their private lives, you know, you get upset with your partner and you slam the door, and then it takes months before you get make up again. And make, you know, we always, as human beings, have this tendency to overreact and do things that we then live to regret. It's just that it has immense consequences if you do that at the political level. In some ways, it would be foolhardy for me to say, well, there is a magic bullet that's going to solve all these problems. First of all, we need to be aware that history has, on occasion, rather repeated itself. I mean, there have been certain times where people have been trying to appeal to populist sentiments. They then get into power. They then follow a particular pattern that seems to be pretty consistent across the board. So if we know what the history has been like before, then we may also be more likely to prevent ourselves from reliving history. So I think history, proper history, can actually be used in a useful way. But then, of course, the other thing is that we can have to see when, you know, how did it work? Like if we take America as an example,
yeah.
It was interesting. About 100 years ago, there was a movement called the Progressives. Now, America at the time was a place where they had just introduced instant communication technology. It was this novel thing called
telephone.
Yes, where you could instantly communicate from one side of the country to the other. You didn't need the Pony Express or the stagecoach and all the rest of it, or even the telegraph. You could instantly communicate. It was a time where a lot of people were skeptical of the elites. They were skeptical of people getting filthy rich. Those were the people who built the railways. And they were skeptical of immigrants with a different religion who sometimes were terrorists. Those people of a very different religion were Catholics from Ireland and Italy. But some of them, of course, were quite violent. And one of the things that happened in America at the time was that America became more democratic. You started electing directly the senators. There were provisions for recall of certain politicians, very rarely used, but he was there as what Woodrow Wilson called a gun behind the door. And you also had opportunities for, if you like, bypassing the legislatures if they were seen to be too corrupt. I don't know if we can just go back, I mean, but to that. But I think America, because America followed that particular route, America then stayed with a number of caveats. If you were black in the South, mm-hmm. of course, it didn't count for you. But in those parts of America, in the North, in the West, it has always been democratic in, not in a party political sense, but, you know, more democratic in the actual sense of the word. That country, that America, stayed democratic, whereas other countries Italy, Germany, and so on, that started exactly at the same level around the turn of the century, Argentina, for example, all of those countries did not introduce those mechanisms for empowering their own people. In all those other countries, because they didn't do that, they then fell prey to demagogues. So I think the way to resolve some of these problems is not for the people to elect demagogues. It is for the people themselves in different ways to take responsibility and find ways in which we can actually engage. Because it's much easier to criticize the elite than it is to criticize yourself. And if you only have yourself to blame, you may be a little bit more practical about things, a little bit more open-minded, and a little bit also mindful that things don't have a simple solution.
Thank you. That's incredibly insightful as, again, we're in the midst of the counting process for our election, and we had record turnout of all time. Now we have more people in the country, but we had record turnout. So there is the possibility that more people will be actively involved because of the divisiveness that's happened in the last 4 years.
I think the divisiveness itself is not necessarily a problem. You can't agree with people. It's good to have disagreement. There was a famous book by Samuel Huntington about American democracy called The Promise of Disharmony, saying, well, we can't agree. But occasionally, when they're really important issues, we will have to agree. And I think in some ways, I tend to be an optimist. I think the big question for America and the world at the moment is democracy a brittle twig? Or is it a bamboo stick that would flip back with vengeance if it's being bent? So either it's a twig that breaks when we try to bend it, or it's a bamboo stick that comes back with immense force when you try to bend it.
So on that thought, we're going to go on break. We are with Maureen Metcalf and Matt Kvortrup, and we are talking about leadership and democracy and referendums at this point in time where across the world we are seeing our democracies tested. So we will be right back. Thank you for joining us.